This is Colombian reggaeton star Maluma. He is among the artists performing now at the Venezuelan Aid Live concert in Cúcuta, Colombia, on the border with Venezuela. It's aimed at benefiting the effort to move tons of humanitarian aid into Venezuela tomorrow. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This is where we begin the roundup this week. The situation developing and evolving along the border with Venezuela, Brazil, and Colombia. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has been responding with his own concert on the Venezuelan side of the Colombian border. He's planning to send aid to people in Colombia. Tomorrow is a big day. Today is a big day in this international showdown. Tomorrow is the day that the Venezuelan interim president Juan Guaido says humanitarian aid will enter his country, which is suffering the world's worst economic collapse. Maduro, instead, has blocked shipments on the Colombian border. An orange truck and blue cargo container are still keeping aid from coming in on the Venezuelan side of the bridge near Cúcuta, Colombia. Senator Marco Rubio was at the border on that bridge just last weekend.
And the people who put those containers there is a terrorist criminal regime. This is what they're willing to do to keep food and medicine from reaching their own people, but it isn't going to work. Food and medicine will reach the people of Venezuela, and so will liberty and democracy.
President Donald Trump reiterated that message this week at Florida International University on Monday. He addressed a crowd of Venezuelan exiles, connecting the crisis in their country to the socialist governments of Cuba and Nicaragua.
We know what freedom can do in Venezuela because we have seen that future right here in Doral. We know what freedom can do in Cuba because we have seen that future right here in Miami. We know what freedom can do in Nicaragua because we have seen that future in Sweetwater.
International diplomacy, international pressure, and the local community here in South Florida on the South Florida Roundup. How should the U.S. government approach the crisis in Venezuela? If you're Venezuelan, what are you hearing from family and friends in the country? What's the latest situation on the border? What about the humanitarian aid? What about the international diplomatic pressure? 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Facebook and send us a tweet at WLRN. WLRN's Tim Padgett is with us. Earlier, Tim and I spoke with the Miami Herald's Jim Wiss via Skype. Jim is in Colombia. Jim, what can you tell us about the humanitarian aid on the border between Colombia and Venezuela?
Well, what we know, Tom, is the aid is there on the border. Tons of aid has come in from the United States, from Brazil, some from Colombia. What's still unclear is how they're going to get it across the border, and that's what we're going to find out this weekend.
What's in the aid? What's included in these packages?
It's mainly non-perishable food and medical supplies. No medicine yet. The administration of Nicolás Maduro has said that pushing the aid into the country is tantamount to a foreign invasion. He's called out the military and blocking that aid from entering.
Isn't this more an optic war than anything else? And if it is an optic war, how does the opposition intend to win it? How do they think Nicolás Maduro will lose it?
Exactly. This aid is very symbolic. This aid is for whoever gets it, it's going to make a big difference, but it's not going to solve the country's problems. And it is this optics war. On one side, you have Guaido, who has a lot of popular support and the backing of many in the international community, including the United States, but he has no real power. And then you have Maduro on the other side, who's been abandoned by the international community and is losing the streets, but still has military support. So Guaido has to prove that he can be effective, even without real power, by getting this aid into the country. And Maduro needs to prove that he still has control over the military by essentially keeping the aid out. If the opposition wanted to get this aid into the country, it could be done relatively easily. The smuggling routes are large and open and very active, and so they could smuggle this in. But it's more than about smuggling it in. It's about making a statement.
And if Maduro does visibly use the military to block this aid, doesn't he really risk a really bad image PR catastrophe you know, essentially showing the world and, more important, Venezuelans inside Venezuela that he's using his soldiers to block desperately needed food and medicine.
I think that's absolutely right, Tim. Up until now, he's already losing the PR war. There, you know, we've all seen the images of the containers stretched across this bridge where aid may be moved across. And there is active resistance for the aid coming in. But what we haven't seen yet is that image of, peaceful, unarmed volunteers trying to bring aid into the country and being stopped by the military.
And speaking of images, Maduro continues to project this image that the humanitarian aid is not needed. There's not a crisis happening. And in the meantime, obviously, the diaspora community here in South Florida has been sharing lots of images that show very, very severe conditions, medical supplies that have run low, food supplies that have run low. How does that wind up playing not only on the border there, Jim, but in terms of this public relations war, this bit of a cold war that's happening?
Right. Well, I think Saturday we should see that and it's in full bloom. As you know, on the Colombian side of the border, there's a big international music festival being put on by Richard Branson and others. And on the other side of the border, Maduro is having his own concert. It's unclear who's going to actually play at that event yet. And the administration is saying they are going to donate 20,000 basically boxes of food into Cúcuta, Colombia. So Maduro is trying to flip the script and saying, not only is there not a crisis in Venezuela, but we are going to attend all those desperate Colombians in Cúcuta by taking them food and taking medical brigades there.
Contending that there's a humanitarian crisis in Colombia across the border, not caused by the exodus of Venezuelans.
Exactly.
Some Colombian military leaders were visiting the Southern Command this week in Doral. What's the status of the engagement with the Colombian military on the border and the developing situation with Venezuela?
Colombia is guarding its border, but has repeatedly said that it does not have plans for any sort of military incursion into Venezuela. And the foreign minister repeated that Colombia's work on this aid project ends at the border. It'll have to be up to Venezuelans to figure out how they get the aid into Venezuela. And there have been no promises made that the military will support them in any way.
And regarding the president's visit here in South Florida, Tim, how do you think that was received here by the expat community? And then, Jim, how was that characterized in the region?
Well, it was received in a rather mixed fashion, I think, by Venezuelan expats themselves. I think we're so used to such a hegemonous reaction to Republican administrations among the Cuban population here, for example, you know, very unified in their response to any actions taken against Cuba. Whereas this hint that Trump keeps dropping about U.S. military intervention still being on the table, I think it troubles a lot of Venezuelan expats, as well as it troubles a lot of Venezuelans in Venezuela, because there's this fear that if that becomes the overriding image here of U.S. intervention, that takes a lot of the energy away from and a lot of the spotlight away from the opposition itself, from Juan Guaido itself, which is supposed to be the engine pushing this whole effort. And we could hear the same thing from Vice President Pence, because he's scheduled, right, Jim, to make a visit to Colombia on Monday.
Exactly. That's right. And I would say Tim is exactly right. Everybody in Trump's circle, but excluding Trump himself, have been very clear that there is no military option on the table. But Trump keeps dropping these hints, and it kind of plays right into Maduro's hands. That's what he's been arguing all along. And if anything, I fear that the kind of ambiguity with which Trump talks about this whole all options are on the table thing does give Maduro some propaganda and political fuel that he would not have otherwise.
So, Jim, let me ask you, how is the American involvement being characterized there in the region, in Colombia, and what is your sense about how it's being characterized inside Venezuela?
Well, I mean, in Venezuela, it's very clear. They're presenting this as a U.S.-backed effort to push questionable aid into Venezuela and suggesting that it may be part of this larger coup plot against Maduro. In the rest of the region, I think it's definitely being seen as a U.S.-led effort. I mean, the USAID has already in the process of delivering $20 million worth of aid to Cucuta, to the on the border with Venezuela. And there's pledges for much more. That being said, Brazil and Chile are getting into the act. And, of course, Colombia is providing a lot of the logistical support.
It is extraordinary how much of Latin America itself has joined the U.S. in this, at least diplomatic effort, which has never really been the case in the past in campaigns like this.
Jim, what are you looking forward to?
Saturday, it will be a big test. And that's what we're all kind of waiting to see. How are they going to get this aid over the border? Are they going to be able to do it without any violence from the military? And, how will Maduro react?
And Jim, one of the big questions, though, is what if this does not have the intended effect? If we're sitting here on Monday with the sensation that, well, this really kind of fizzled, what happens then?
I we're 4 weeks into this kind of political duel and crisis since Juan Guaido declared himself president due to all sorts of constitutional issues. I think this is a process, not an event. And I think this aid push is part of this larger process. This alone is not going to tilt the balance, I fear.
The Miami Herald's Jim Wiss speaking with us from Colombia via Skype earlier this week. WLRN's Tim Padgett is still with us. Tim, while a lot of focus has been on this border crossing between Venezuela and Colombia, meantime, there has been an outbreak of skirmishes, some violence, some deadly violence, in fact, today here on this Friday on the border between Venezuela and Brazil. What do we know?
Right. One of the things that's gotten lost in all of this showdown hype is the fact that, we were also trying to get aid into other parts of the border of Venezuela, at Brazil, but also a maritime border with Curaçao and Aruba, et cetera. I think it took a lot of people by surprise this morning when we heard that there are at least two dead in a clash with Venezuelan military there who were closing. Maduro had ordered that the border with Brazil be closed as well, and an indigenous community down there on the border with Brazil was trying to get the border back open, not only because of the aid, but because they depend so heavily economically on having the traffic open at that border point. They had a clash with the Venezuelan military this morning. As I said, at least two dead, at more than a dozen injured, and that is not looking good for Maduro at all.
800-743-9576, the phone number if you want to call and talk about Venezuela and the developing, evolving situation there. You can also send us a text, 786-786-7636. The text line, 786-786-7636. Nora Gámez-Torres is with us now with El Nuevo Herald. She's with us via FaceTime. Nora, you were on that humanitarian aid plane that was carrying some American politicians over this past weekend. What are the options that they're talking about privately as we move toward what could be what is a standoff as we move toward some kind of conclusion perhaps about this humanitarian standoff on Saturday?
I think I will have to agree with Jim that privately they're just waiting and seeing what happened today and tomorrow. Privately, there's no eagerness in any sort of military intervention. Like, I asked several officials and politicians, and they really don't want to talk about intervention right now. They're really hoping that this combined push of, Guaido and this caravan to get the aid, the concert that's happening today at the border, and the whole, also economic pressure via sanctions, that finally this comes through tomorrow and, the U.S. is not forced or inclined to, have a plan B. Mm-hmm. That said, there's a lot of uncertainty even within the U.S. government. I don't think anyone is sure what comes next.
With that uncertainty, Nora, and so much focus on the Saturday deadline about this humanitarian aid, Tim's question to Jim Wiss earlier, what does come next on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday? The vice president coming to that region in Colombia, certainly the deaths that we're seeing today on the border between Brazil and Venezuela will require some kind of at least a statement, I imagine, from the Brazilian government here. I mean, what about the options that are left on the table within the region as we look beyond just the humanitarian deadline of Saturday?
Right. Well, yeah, I think it's important to point out what you were mentioning, that this is a regional effort. So I think there's a lot of, you know, conversations going on among the governments. And also, I think we don't know the extent of the conversations between the opposition and members of the military, and also maybe the U.S. government, in trying to find an exit to this. I think part of a solution could be finding an exit to Maduro, but there's also, you know, the problem with other high-ranking officials like Diosdado Cabello, which are not really, you know, very popular, not even in, you know, allied countries like Cuba.
Yeah, Tim.
So yeah, at the same time, I mean, there's several conversations going on in the region.
And what about that point, Tim, in terms of kind of the second level of Maduro's administration? You know, the president comes to Doral, obviously focusing the effort, focusing the South Florida and the Venezuelan exile community on Maduro. He is certainly the figurehead. He is the leader. But it is not solely one individual. It is an apparatus that has been in place there for a long time.
Well, as Nora just mentioned, there are figures like Diosdado Cabello, who is, you know, essentially the number two, but a lot of people would say he's actually the number one power in Venezuela. And he really sort of holds a lot of the reins on the military. And that's the key. It still is the key. We keep saying it week after week because it's true. The key here is the military. Until they abandon Maduro, nothing is really going to happen in terms of dislodging this socialist dictatorship in Venezuela. So how do you turn the military? I don't know if this, again, as we called it before, this optics war with the humanitarian aid is really going to influence the military's feeling about its loyalty to Maduro. What is eventually going to be money. When the money runs out in Venezuela, and that could happen soon, because we're hearing all kinds of reports that Venezuela's foreign reserves are leaking out like a sieve right now, at close to $5 billion, which is very low. And so when that money runs out, I think that's when we're going to see crunch time for the military. Do they still see this regime as being viable and sustainable?
Nora, how about that conversation on that plane last week in regards to Tim's point about just the hard currency challenges that the Venezuelan and Maduro regime have got to be facing? The gold reserves continue to wind down. It's shipping gold out of the country, trying to sell it and turn it into hard currency. Obviously, selling oil and getting that back into hard currency is darn near impossible for the United States to do that. How about that pressure?
Well, right. Actually, yeah, there's been a lot of pressure in cutting, you know, the money route for Maduro and his allies. And you have seen, like, Senator Rubio's tweeting constantly, you know, anytime that a news comes out that Maduro is trying to get, like, the gold somewhere else or doing some sort of transaction. But I wanted to mention also, like, there's also this pressure to specific military officials. And some of them, at the end of the day, might be inclined to, you know, support Guaido in seeking an exit, because these are people that are under sanctions and they have the money outside the country, and the U.S. has some sort of power to get that money and freeze it.
And under indictment in the United States as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you see, yesterday, this general, former, you know, head of the military intelligence, pledging support to Guaido.
Hugo Carbajal,
Who is actually sick in the United States for, you know, drug trafficking. So is he, what is his strategy? Is he trying to, you know, make a deal, support Guaido, you know, and then don't have to respond to the U.S. Law? Let's see. I mean, we're going to see more of those, you know, deals or, you know, pledges in the future. And that's the hope of the U.S. Officials in private.
Yeah. In meantime, obviously watching the border between Venezuela and Colombia, Venezuela and Brazil, some violence there breaking out today on the Brazilian-Venezuelan border. We're looking for that humanitarian aid and this deadline on Saturday. Nora Gámez-Torres with us via FaceTime. She reports for El Nuevo Herald. Nora, always great to have you on the roundup. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Earlier, we spoke with Jim Wiss from our partner, the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett with us covering all things Latin America and the Caribbean for us here at WLRN. Timothy, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it. The live concert underway in Cucuta, Colombia, the Venezuelan aid live concert there, watching that border. The Colombian reggaeton star Maluma among the artists that are playing there. And, of course, the Maduro concert on the other side of the border happening as well. We got plenty more to come here on the South Florida Roundup. More after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. The case against Jeffrey Epstein included accusations of having sex with underage girls, international sex trips, and prostitution. The case now includes a judge's decision this week that federal prosecutors in South Florida broke the law by keeping their plea agreement with Epstein secret. At the time, prosecutors were led by Alex Acosta. He was the U.S. attorney in South Florida when the deal was struck. Today, Acosta is the United States Secretary of Labor. The judge's ruling this week follows the Miami Herald's investigative series, Perversion of Justice, by Julie Brown. Julie joins us now via FaceTime. Julie, this ruling came from the federal judge Kenneth Mara in West Palm Beach. What does it conclude about this plea deal back in 2009?
Well, it concludes a couple of pretty powerful things. Number one, he concludes that prosecutors essentially locked Epstein's victims out of the criminal justice process in violation of the Crime Victims' Rights Act. This is an act that was passed by Congress that gave victims certain rights, such as being able to confer with prosecutors, being informed of plea deals, to make them part of the criminal justice process, and that they deliberately violated this act. And furthermore, he ruled that prosecutors also misled them, essentially lied to them about the status of the case toward the end of the process.
How significant is this for a federal judge to essentially accuse federal prosecutors of breaking federal law?
I'm told that this is really unusual, that this almost never happens. I don't know if we even have a precedent that this has ever happened before. We had believe that perhaps he would censor them, or he would, you know, they could come up with, the government had argued, well, we didn't do it for this reason. They had a number of reasons why they said, and they were hoping, I think, that the judge would, you know, let them slide on this and say that they meant to contact them, but they didn't for this reason or another reason.
So what's the result of this ruling on the plea deal itself, the deal that had Jeffrey Epstein pleading guilty to two state charges of prostitution and serving, what, about a year or so in county jail?
Right. Well, this is uncharted territory. Just as the judge's decision, it was rare to even make this kind of a ruling saying the prosecutors broke the law. It's even more rare for, I don't know if it's ever been done before, where they threw out some kind of a plea bargain as a result of them violating this law. So I think the judge is waiting to see what the government is going to do. Now, possibly what the government can do is on its own say, look, we're going to throw this out and we're going to open a grand jury case on this and we're going to look at this. Because let's face it, over the years, this was 10 years ago, over the years, there has been many other victims that have come forward, not only in Florida, but also in New York and even overseas. It's apparent from the judge's decision, by the way, that he has reviewed materials that weren't public. He has mentioned some things in his decision that weren't in the court record, because I've read the entire court record and there's a couple little things in there. For example, he mentions that this was an international sex trafficking operation in which Epstein not only used these girls and abused them on his own, but he also had them have sex with other people.
And that's really not been mentioned in a court document that I've seen. So he's apparently seen some documents that have been sealed.
Yeah, there's a line in this ruling from Judge Mara saying, quote, Epstein worked in concert with others to obtain minors not only for his own sexual gratification, but also for the sexual gratification of others. Could Epstein face new charges from this kind of ruling? I mean, does this then spark even state prosecutors perhaps to reopen the case? And the state prosecutors, and we know the local police in Palm Beach had been pushing hard for this case 10, 12 years ago before the feds came in and took it over.
Yeah, to their credit, the former police chief, Mike Ritter, and his detective who recently passed away, they were the only two people really that fought for these girls, and as well as the girls' attorneys, but they were the only two people in law enforcement that fought for these girls. Look, I think that it's possible that the statute of limitations could kick in on the state charges, but here's the thing, there's no statute of limitations for sex trafficking, especially federal sex trafficking. So, and plus the fact that this crossed state lines, it's an interstate crime, potentially, it would make more sense for the Department of Justice to either reopen the case or launch a new investigation.
Are there new allegations included in this judge's ruling, do you think, Julie? Allegations that perhaps may not be covered by the original plea agreement that the judge has essentially called illegal?
Well, he's basing the statement about using these girls for his sexual gratification and the gratification of others on something he's seen. So we know that there were documents not only here in Florida that were filed as part of court record, but also in New York that had been sealed. In fact, the Herald is still in court trying to unseal a court case in New York to find out more information about Epstein's crimes. And so we don't know if exactly what the judge saw, but something led him to make that conclusion. I don't think, you know, he would have written something like that in a court document had he not seen some pretty convincing evidence that there has been other crimes that happened outside of the state of Florida.
Has there been any specific language in this ruling, as you've read it, regarding the role that Alex Acosta played as the U.S. attorney of the Southern District when this plea deal was struck?
Well, the judge obviously took a lot of time to read all the correspondence, emails, and letters that went that were exchanged between the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami and Epstein's lawyers. Among those that he cites in the judge cites in his ruling are a couple of letters and emails that were sent to Acosta and from Acosta to Epstein's lawyers. In fact, a couple of them I don't know if I've seen before, so I don't even know if they were part of the public record. But it's clear that he had this private meeting at a Marriott hotel with Epstein's lawyer right around the time that this deal was signed. And as a result of that meeting, he agreed to keep it confidential. He agreed to seal this document. And even after that, several of his people under him, the first assistant attorney, Jeff Sloman, for example, had tried to inform the victims. He wrote emails saying to Epstein's attorney, we have to let the victims know about this now. And it's clear that then Epstein's attorneys appealed to Acosta, and Acosta was the one that said, no, this is confidential.
Now, in a statement after this ruling this week, through a spokesperson at the Department of Labor, where Acosta is the secretary now, and you reported on this, Julie, you got this statement. A portion of that mm-hmm. statement reads, quote, the office's decisions were approved by departmental leadership and followed departmental procedures. What's the secretary saying there? Essentially that the federal Department of Justice, Washington, D.C., in other words, maybe even the Attorney General of the United States at the time, knew this deal and okayed it?
Well, he is saying that, but my research on this, if you look at the public record, shows that essentially what happened was the Department of, you know, Epstein's lawyers kept trying to get a better deal for him, even after the plea deal was signed in September of 2007. And all the way from then until May of 2008, they appealed to the Justice Department in Washington, alleging that or claiming that ACOSTA didn't have any jurisdiction. There was no federal jurisdiction, that this was a state case. And in May of 2008, the Justice Department wrote back to Epstein's lawyers and essentially said, you're wrong. This is a federal case. ACOSTA is within his right to prosecute this. So that's what I know from the public record. In other words, it contradicts essentially what ACOSTA says, because it was ACOSTA that made the decision.
And we know that the current Department of Justice has initiated an investigation after your reporting here, Julie. I want to ask you about the victims, the now women, the then girls who were involved in the case. The ruling that came this week that calls into question the plea deal and some of the secrecy around it came in a case where two victims were suing. What have the victims said to you here in the hours after this ruling?
You know, they're optimistic. Let's put it this way: more optimistic than they had been before. Obviously, this is a big step. But you know, I think that ultimately, what the kind of justice they want is to see him go to prison. And you know, we're still a far cry from that with this. So I think, like I said, they're happy that they're finally being listened to. They're really elated that they're finally being treated as victims, because that was part of their complaint all along, was that these girls were, you know, 13, 14, 15, and they were treated like they were prostitutes. They were never really treated by prosecutors as victims. And that's really the travesty here for these girls. Prosecutors never really treated them like they were victims.
And this case, where this ruling came this week, still continues. This isn't the final ruling of this lawsuit. The judge's ruling giving what prosecutors and attorneys for the victims a couple of weeks now to kind of respond to this ruling.
Yeah, they have about 15 days. They have to get together. Of course, they could, I guess, ask for more time. I guess I wouldn't be surprised if they ask for more time and are granted more time. This is, as we talked about earlier, has never really happened before. So I think a lot of people are not sure what to do. But I would expect that the victims' attorneys are going to try to nullify this plea deal in some form. And how that'll happen, I mean, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Julie Brown has been reporting on this exhaustively, sharing with the public what she has been finding through court records and difficult but important interviews with the victims as well. Award-winning investigative journalist Julie Brown with us from our partner, the Miami Herald. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Still to come on our program, after 20 years, homeless people in Miami could lose court-ordered protections for some police action. So what are the rules now? How has the city's treatment of homeless people changed? That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. A landmark agreement that protected homeless people in the city of Miami is now gone. Last Friday, a federal judge ruled to terminate the Pottinger Agreement. It prevented law enforcement officers from arresting homeless people for quality of life activities, things like sleeping on the sidewalk and loitering. The U.S. District Judge in this case said the agreement is no longer needed. He found that the city had mended its relationship with homeless people, putting in place shelters and social services since the early 1990s when the Pottinger case began. Benjamin Waxman is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. He argued the case that would become known as the Pottinger Agreement. In an interview with WLRN, Waxman said things have gotten better, but he's still concerned about the future.
Our concern is looking forward. People change, administrations change, police department chiefs change, And with those changes, people can revert back to old strategies and tactics.
Number of cities in South Florida have had difficulty coming up with strategies to effectively tackle the homeless problem and work with homeless individuals. We've seen this in Fort Lauderdale, certainly. We've seen it over the years in Miami. So what is a city's role in addressing homelessness? How should the city of Miami specifically move forward now that protections for homeless people have ended? What's your experience with homelessness? Perhaps you've dealt with it yourself. You've seen it in your community. What are your thoughts here? It is an open conversation. 800-743-WLRN to have your voice be heard. 800-743-9576. You could also send us a tweet. That number is 786, or rather send us a text, 786-786-7636. So text us at 786-786-7636. Miami Herald reporter Joy Fletches is along with us right now, who covers the city of Miami for our partner, the Miami Herald. So let's begin at the beginning here. This Pottinger Agreement dates back to 1998, but the threads of that case go back even further, 25 years or so now, right?
That's right. In the late 80s, a class of 5,000 homeless people came together, represented by attorneys with the ACLU, and they sued the city of Miami. And back then, the practice was to do these cleanups where homeless people were arrested. And so that was a reaction to the police practice of undue harassment. And that was litigated for years, and it ended a protracted litigation with this agreement. This decree, it's a consent decree,
right,
that basically prevented police from arresting homeless people for these life-sustaining activities. At the time, that included not just sleeping on the sidewalk, but also having an open fire to cook, public urination. Mm-hmm. There were certain protections that basically allowed you to live on the street.
Yeah.
And since then, it's been amended. It had been amended even before this motion that was made by the city to dissolve it. There were more bathrooms sprung up, so there were extra rules for like when you could actually urinate in public, and the open fire provision was removed too. But the very basics of it, which was that you could not, for loitering, for sleeping on the sidewalk, you know, you could not arrest a homeless person.
How much of a landmark did this agreement represent? Not just in Florida, but frankly nationwide. I mean, did other cities kind of look at this agreement in terms of how to police their own police relationships with the homeless population?
It set a tone that created a conversation across the country in other big cities. It forced government agencies to try to figure out how they could mimic it and it became sort of a best practice for recognizing the humanity and the plight of homelessness without being punitive, without throwing people in jail. Even locally, so Miami, the city of Miami, was the only jurisdiction where this applied.
Right.
So right next door in Coral Gables or anywhere else, it did not.
Or the beach or anywhere. Right.
But in the case of the beach, for example, they say that they followed the rules. They tried to keep in with Pottinger, and so they weren't automatically arresting people.
Yeah.
There's reports that I've heard from residents downtown and business owners downtown that say that they saw homeless people move across the bridge and get dropped off in downtown Miami. I've never heard anybody substantiate that completely, but there are business owners who might be listening right now that said that they've seen that. So
yeah,
that created a part of the, you know, well, what commissioners were upset about.
And so what led to the mayor of Miami, Mayor Francis Suarez, really kind of led the effort for the court to reconsider this consent decree and to try to argue the case that after 20 years of these guidelines, they're no longer necessary for the relationship between Miami City Police and the homeless population?
This was a bit of a slow burn.
Yeah.
It was over the last several years and included Francis Suarez from the time he was a commissioner. And there were several other commissioners that really jumped on board over the years. And by the time that the motion was made last spring to try to dissolve this in federal court, it was a unanimous decision. Mm-hmm. And each of them have said they brought up different aspects of what they perceive to be the problem, including that it might be stunting growth in downtown, which has already grown quite a bit and boomed, and so therefore created a clash between the resident population and the folks living on the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about the unfairness, how no other municipality is held to this, and so therefore, you know, it should be everybody or nobody at all. The argument from the administration side has been that the city of Miami has learned to be compassionate, right, has learned to steer people into services, and therefore they shouldn't be hamstrung, and police shouldn't have to second guess their actions when they're around homeless people.
Let me bring in Ron Book now. He heads up the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust. It is a countywide organization looking at homelessness, not just in the city of Miami, but it certainly covers that. Ron, welcome back to WLRN and the Roundup. You're with us via FaceTime. What are your thoughts about dropping Pottinger?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity. And I want to, just for a second, off topic, just thank Julie Brown, who was on your last segment,
yes,
for the work she did in the Epstein case.
Yes, thank you, Ron.
It was outstanding. Listen, I think that I had very deep concerns when the ACLU and others entered into negotiations for the prior amendments to Pottinger. They went ahead with those amendments voluntarily. I believed then that that was the beginning of the end of Pottinger. And in the end, that is, in fact, what occurred. When I had testify and I responded to many questions that the judge posed, I had to concede that where we are now, having started 25 years ago leading the Homeless Trust, today our budget's about $65 million in the fight to end homelessness, where we have reduced street homelessness over that period of time of Pottinger by over 90%.
Yep.
We had a little over 8,000 people living on the streets back then.
Mm-hmm.
We had our most recent point in time count. It's called a PIT count.
Yep.
And we had that was done for.
Ron, the FaceTime connection's breaking up a little bit. You were talking about the point in time homeless count. The last number I have dates back to 2018 of about 3,500. Can you update us on that number? We lost Ron. We will get him back on the telephone here, Ron Book, with the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust. We are talking about homelessness in Miami. Pottinger Agreement, a consent decree from a court regulating how Miami City Police can deal with the homeless population. That is no longer the case. Your experience, you can share it with us at 800-743-9576. Joy Fletches covers the city of Miami for our partner, the Miami Herald. Quick phone call from Jeff in Key West has some thoughts. Jeff, thank you for holding on. Let's see. We're going to finish up with Jeff and get to you in a moment. Ron Book was talking about the homeless population and how it has changed in the county, Joy Fletches. It has dropped significantly. But what are the kind of mechanisms that the city has put in place that the city kind of used as evidence to the judge in this case to say the Pottinger rules and guidelines for the interaction between law enforcement and the homeless population are no longer needed?
Some of the programs in place include what are called the green shirts, which are actual city employees that work as homeless outreach advocates, and they go out and they walk the streets. They connect homeless people with certain services, whether it be shelter like a Camillus house, mm-hmm, or rehabilitation programs if they're suffering from drug addiction, things like that. The police also have they coordinate with those green shirts, and for a long time they were all trained for Pottinger treatment, trained to not do certain things. And part of what brought this on was actually the ACLU saying that the police were violating Pottinger. They actually motioned that there was a violation occurring because of some cleanups that were occurring where they felt that personal belongings of the people on the street were being discarded.
Yeah.
And there was a heavy-handedness to it.
There's some recent concerns about that outside the city of Miami, but still within Miami-Dade County. Ron Book, the head of the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust, back with us via FaceTime. Ron, you were talking about your point-in-time count of the homeless population. When Pottinger was put into place, the homeless population in Dade County, 8,000 or so. The last number we have, about 3,500. Get us updated there. Oh, we lost Ron again. We will do our best again to hook up with him. But that population, Joey, has dropped.
Yes.
The data shows that. We have seen some instances more recently outside the city of Miami about police interactions with homeless, some in Fort Lauderdale, certainly, but some in Hialeah. We've seen some use of public health concerns in regards to spaces that the homeless population tend to congregate.
It's true. Even in the city of Miami, that was a very recent concern. And it was interesting to see in the same weeks that Pottinger was being argued in federal court, less than a mile away under the I-395 overpass in Overtown, there was a conversation happening between some of the organizations associated with the city, groups like the Homeless Trust and Judge Lifeman, who works in mental health, and the Idea Needle Exchange deals with clean needles for people who are injecting drugs. Right. They all had to sort of talk to each other because they wanted to clean up this area. The city wanted to clean up this area under the overpass that had a lot of homeless people and a lot of drug use. So, and the idea was that the neighbors weren't having it anymore.
Right.
The folks who live right in those apartments nearby, the kids who walk to school, they didn't want to have to see these people there. And that, you know, raises a really tough question, which is like these people, they were protected. They had a right to be there. And the policies protected them from any kind of abuse or, you know, harassment and being moved. But then the city had the right to clean up. So.
Yeah. Ron Book is back with us here. Old school cellular telephone this time around. Hopefully this technology will work, Ron. Thanks for your persistence here. Get us updated on the point in time, though. The point in time population of homeless in Dade County is what these days?
We are at 1,008 still on the street. And while it's 1,008, it's still a 90% decrease from where we started 25 years ago, and a continued downtick with each count. Our total street population was down again in January by a little over 2%, just like our count in August was. The only place in our community that had an increase was Miami Beach, which showed an overall increase of 23%. We are trying to address some of those issues with Miami Beach officials. And I'm optimistic that for the first time in the 25 and a half years that the Homeless Trust has been in existence, the end of homelessness in Miami-Dade County is within sight. Are we short some revenue to get there? We are, but we are working on a plan which, if we are successful, within 24 months, Miami-Dade County will be able to announce as the first community in the country to be at the end of homelessness. Does that mean every person will be off the streets? We can't solve mental illness with everybody, nor can we solve substance abuse and alcohol. But we should be in a position similar to how you described full employment in America. We should be down to where the only people on the street are those who just won't come in. We believe mechanically, we believe socially, that those that are on the streets, about 72% are in that chronic category.
Mm-hmm.
A chronic is described by HUD as someone living on the streets for 365 or more continuous days, or have had four or more instances of homelessness in a 3-year period.
Ron, our time is really tight here, but you are talking about the potential end of homelessness in Miami-Dade County, potentially within 2 years. We've got just about a minute left, and I know there's a lot to talk about here, but what are the contributing factors for that expectation to become a reality?
We need Miami Beach, Surfside, and Bounce Harbor, which are the only three communities in all of Miami-Dade where the food and beverage tax is not charged in their restaurants. The resources that would come from the adoption of that food and beverage tax there, which has to be first approved by resolution by those city commissions, then by the legislature.
So you need revenue, Ron, is what you're asking about.
We need
money. Go ahead, Joey.
Because the balance of the chronic is a housing first model, and it just costs us more to finish the job.
Do you think that
we're there as a community,
Mr. Book? Do you think that the point in time count for Miami Beach is going to be a part of that conversation that you bring to the beach when you ask them about this revenue, about this tax?
And I'll let you know, we got 30 seconds left, Ron.
We have reminded them over and over, and I told them 2 years ago, and I told them a year ago, because of a number of things they weren't doing, that this was going to happen. It has occurred. You can't make it up. The bodies on the streets are the bodies on the streets.
Ron, we're going to follow up with you. We got to leave it there. We cannot stop time, unfortunately. Ron Book along with us. He is heading up the Miami-Dade County Homeless Trust. Joy Fletcher covers the city of Miami for our partner, the Miami Herald. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Director of Radio Operations is Peter J. Meritz, and Jason Zabka is our program director.